Laying into the movies. Hey girl, curl up on now with our smooth part. But you just wanna know what's on our mind. How do we think it goes? So plug in those headphones. It's late to the movies.
Yeah, I guess we should start with RIP OJ.
Ray wants to talk about this for 20 to 40 minutes.
I don't.
It was legitimately like we got to the end of the ladies episode and there was like 30 minutes left in the recording and we had already talked about what we won our best picture and I was like, what is the rest of this recording? And then Ray, what, this is just like what happened to OJ or whatever. I was like, oh, that was the last 45 minutes.
It was the opposite.
And it
was. It was the opposite.
You got it going again. Oh my goodness.
I just listened to that.
Unlike the opposite of what happened to OJ, does anyone know anyone who was just born?
What?
As opposed to dying?
Oh. No.
It was like, it's best I could do. I don't know any babies. Then nothing came to mind.
I know a lot of babies, but none that are that fresh.
Yeah, you need a fresh baby. Like,
yeah.
Both in terms of newness and just like being cool in the 90s somehow. I don't know. So with that said, I think that's a perfect intro to this episode. Let's just do it. As you guys know, I don't know how to start the podcast. So it'll either be Ray insisting we spend time talking about OJ again, or something along the lines of welcome to Lady of the Movies. My name is Ben Holt. This podcast where my friends and I get to fill in our movie blind spots. Each week we'll pick a film that either I or a guest hadn't seen before and really should have by now. This week, continuing our one night only theme this month, which I would hope is self-explanatory, but if not, I'll explain later. It's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Mike Nichols' debut film based on the 1962 play by Edward Albee. I think the movie was 66. So there you go. That's all. That's all the biological information, biographical, whatever. This isn't going well. Your guest left, right, across your perfect style. We got Lindsay.
Oh,
we got, Greg.
Oh, hey.
With two G's. Craig with one G. There he is over there. Ray. And Marshall.
Hello.
Hello. As always, before we get too into the movie, curious if anyone's seen anything good recently.
This is exactly what Letterboxd is for. I'll be right back.
Well, I don't think I've seen anything. Now that the Oscars are over, I've chilled out on my movie watching for a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, I actually know. I was bored the other night because Ray wasn't home. I rewatched The Martian. I like that movie.
Nice.
It's a good movie to sit down and just relax and watch. It's nice with popcorn.
Oh, a new Bluey episode dropped.
Yo.
I came to realize this right after I finished watching this movie last week, but I saw, I'm pretty certain, the longest movie I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
Which is A Brighter Summer Day, the Edward Yang movie. It's a, like, Taiwanese filmmaker. But anyways, I was aware of this movie for years just because it was in the Criterion Collection, but I hadn't seen it. And, like, the local art house was, like, playing a retrospective of all of his movies this month. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I've seen a few 3.5 hour movies, which is still very long. But I was like, 4 hours? I don't think I've seen one that's 4 hours. But I'm happy to report that it was a good movie. Yes. I enjoyed it.
Did it have an intermission?
No intermission. Yeah. The guy at the box office was just like talking to somebody else also seeing the movie. He's like, yeah, there's no intermission. Just letting you know now. People did not know that for the previous screening.
I don't know the longest movie I've ever seen is in theaters. I think technically, I mean, not to stay on OJ, but OJ Made in America counted as a movie for the Academy Awards purposes, and that's like 9 hours long. Mm. But I watched it, the TV version that was split into 4 or 5 episodes. Sure. But technically, it's a movie, I guess.
I definitely kind of consider some miniseries sort of like, I know that one's technically not a miniseries, but like there are certain stories like that that are one off that I kind of in my head just think of as a movie, like Mayor of Easttown or something. You know, it's just, it's one long story. Yeah. You know, it feels like a movie. I don't know. But yeah, definitely for like a theatrical screening, 4 hours.
Relevant to today, one of the longest movies ever, just based on a quick Reddit search, like Hollywood movies theatrically released, is the 60s Cleopatra movie starring Liz Taylor and Richard Burton, who also star in this movie.
Marshall and I also watched, this is not related to a long movie, but Silo, the show on Amazon Prime?
Apple.
Shoot. A show on Apple. That was good.
That's one of the things I've talked about on this before. And not, I don't know,
really, oh, really?
With you, but not specifically that, but just in terms of every time I turn on Apple, there's another show that had to cost tens of millions of dollars with like really famous people in it that apparently has been nominated for a bunch of awards that I've never heard of. And Silo's been that once, because that's Rebecca Ferguson, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love.
There's like a few. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Lady Jessica.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's like a few other named actors in that show too, but it I don't want to like spoil much, but she's definitely the main character.
Is that the one that I was like reading the cast list and like Common is like the sixth person mentioned and is yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was thinking of the Monarch show, which is technically in the same universe as the Godzilla and King Kong movies, and it's got Kurt Russell and Wyatt Russell playing the same character in different time periods. It's like, this is All things I like and didn't know about. They need to advertise better, because that should have gotten to me and I didn't know about it until I was just turning on the Apple app to rent something from iTunes.
I like that, like as the like experiment or concept or whatever you want to call it, like the Kurt and his son playing the same character in different time periods. I just have no interest in watching that show. One of my really good friends is a huge Godzilla fan, and I don't even think he's watched it. So I'm like, if he's like not the target audience, like who is actually watching this show?
Yeah,
I did see a clip of it once on Twitter, I think, and I was like, oh no, that was a cool sequence.
Yeah,
but again, I'm just
good.
It's like this. I mean, like I guess it's slightly different than like the new Godzilla Kong, even though it's like in the same universe. But I just don't care. And I liked Godzilla Minus One, but that's like a completely different thing.
Yeah. Okay. Academy Award winning film, Godzilla Minus One. I don't think Godzilla X Kong is going to win anything, but I do like, currently in theaters, I do like that the cover, it's like, it's Godzilla and Kong, and they're like, you know, shoulder to shoulder, like, yeah, we're about to fuck some things up because we're like, we're way too anthropomorphized now in the American versions. They should have
just been like back to back.
They should have been. Yeah. They really should have. It's great. In my head, I was like, we're doing like the Pretty Woman poster, like once the tie over the shoulder, the other one.
I had to suffer through watching that trailer so many times and just like rolling my eyes each watch. But I was just thinking to myself, this trailer would have been so much better if the music they use was The Boys Are Back in Town instead. Like everyone would have went and saw that movie.
You should have recut that.
I know.
I feel like that trailer recut with Boys Are Back in Town would have gotten so many millions of views on YouTube in 2007. Like that was exactly where the culture was at the time.
That trailer, along with there's a couple others in the when we went to see Dune 2, where me and Robbie were watching these trailers and we were like, what are we watching trailer for? And Robbie leans over and goes, this, I feel like these are like parody trailers you'd see in a movie where somebody goes to the movie theater. And I was like, yes.
And what else? Oh yeah, and Civil War, which I wanted to ask about because I noticed that you logged it on Letterboxd like a month ago.
Is that me?
Yeah. How'd you do that?
So that was actually the one movie I saw at South by Southwest this year. My buddy had a badge that he wasn't using like the last 3 days of the festival, and I managed to slip out to see that one. We could talk about it for a while. I don't want to like spoil anything. I would say there's definitely stuff to like about it. And if the trailer is has made you interested in seeing the movie, it's worth watching. I didn't love the movie, but I think there's definitely elements to enjoy about it. Yeah. Enjoy sounds like a weird way to describe kind of the topic of the movie. But yeah, there's some like good filmmaking in it. But ultimately, I feel like maybe didn't quite hit what it was maybe trying to achieve. I don't know. We could talk about it once people actually see it, maybe.
As we're recording it, it's coming out tonight here. So.
Oh, that was the one of the ones where I was like, this seems like a parody of a trailer. And also, I remember was watching the trailer and be like, man, read the room. Like, what are you thinking with this movie?
To be fair, I think all of Alice Garland's movies have trailers that look like parodies of sci-fi or like dystopian movies. Because his last movie was Men, which I didn't see in quite an entirely empty theater, but almost. Empty would have been better. Weird movie to see with strangers.
I feel like the Men trailer is thinking back on it, because I didn't actually see the movie.
There's men in it.
I gathered that, but thinking back on seeing the trailer, it just makes me think of like an SNL sketch or something of a fake movie trailer. Just the same actor popping up and like different. I don't know if it's like literally different characters or if it's just the same dude in different outfits. But that would be.
It's kind of both.
Okay.
But because I was excited about Alex Garland, but the thing that I didn't really watch anything since the last recording, but I did read a couple books that have movie adaptations, including Annihilation, which he made in 2018, maybe, but the book's from 2014. I read the book. I hadn't watched the movie ever because I was still putting it off until I read the book. Now I read the book, so I'll watch that movie. Maybe before the next time I record, I don't know. All right. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Not just a relevant question, but also the name of the movie this episode. I don't know, whatever. So the theme this month is One Night Only. Every movie we're doing takes place at least in a 24-hour period. The first one we did, there's some daytime in there, whatever. It's fine. This one, an extremely concentrated night, almost in real time. I think probably the closest to real time of any movie that we're doing.
It almost felt slower than real time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. As the night drags on, definitely in the final act, it gets, you're feeling it. It takes an effort, no doubt. So this is, I've only seen this movie a couple times. The first time I watched it was, I can't exactly pinpoint it because it was early COVID times and everything was like, I don't know. I guess I just wanted to be in a headspace where I felt like I was trapped in a situation where I couldn't get out of it. Or maybe just I wanted to feel like I was spending some time with friends. Either way. At least these people are having a social occasion and it's enviable in that sense. But yeah, so I've only seen it a couple times now. And the first time only a few years ago. How about y'all?
My first watch.
Mine too.
Yeah, I had never seen it before.
Yeah, I hadn't either.
Cool. I didn't intend that to happen, but hey.
Wow. Look all at that. Good.
Bunch of newbies.
Bunch of newbies. Cool. I don't even have to ask if you all liked it because we've talked openly about how much we all loved this movie. And no one's going to disagree with that after a 1 minute plot summary, I'm sure. Anyone feel like doing a 1 minute plot summary?
So I can, but I don't know that you'll love my summary.
I mean, if anything, I love any summary that is even shorter than a minute. I feel like maybe that's what you'd aim for in this one.
Yep. Okay. Okay. I can give you one. Okay. So a couple comes home from a party at 2:30 in the morning. The husband finds out that the wife invited guests from the party over. They get way too much more drunk and then commit domestic violence in front of their guests who just want to leave but can't because the woman's husband is the woman's father's the boss of the guests, and it's a disaster. They end up trying to leave, and the wife is flirting with the guests, and it's a disaster. Eventually, they manage to leave and try to go home, but they're brought back to the place. There's fighting the whole time. There's weird games going on. You really don't know what is a truth and what's not this whole time. The wife sleeps with one of the guests, and then the husband tells her their kid is dead and he ate the telegram, which they don't have a kid as far as I can tell. And then she cries and it's the morning.
Yeah.
Pretty perfect.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. So I already mentioned Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. I feel like normally when we cover something for the first time and it's including really important people in film history or people who were extremely famous celebrities at the time, like the biggest celebrities in the 60s, their relationship, the stuff of tabloid legend, and this movie obviously capitalizing on that being a hot topic at the time. But I also feel like anytime I do go into like a deep bio thing, I end up cutting that out because like, who gives a shit? So, whenever I'm editing these, what I cut out the most is myself talking and monologuing and not like talking to you guys. So I'm not going to do that. Suffice to say, people were really interested in this movie when it came out because they themselves were tabloid fodder. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I caused a scene at Smith College where the exteriors of this movie are shot. The house that they're in looks pretty much the same now. You can go see it in Northampton, Massachusetts. And they had to have like crazy security details and it was like causing traffic problems because people were trying to look at them, you know, and disrupting the shoot and all everything. So
they just shot it at that house. It's not in like a big warehouse in Atlanta.
So, you mean a conference room in Atlanta where all Marvel movies are shot. The exteriors are a house. I think the inside looks like a stage, and it's the play that it's based on all takes place in that living room. And so it was controversial that they leave the house at a couple points in the movie, but yeah. Anyway, all that to say, I know this is a first time watch for everybody, but this is our second Mike Nichols movie. Our first one was our first episode of the entire podcast back in October of 2021, The Birdcage, which is like 30 years after this movie comes out. And he makes a lot of really important movies in between. There you go. That's my Mike Nichols bio for this one. I like a lot of his movies, but we don't have to, whatever. You know, I feel like all that stuff's boring. All that to say, what did you guys think of this movie?
I was going to say, I want to hear, well, I guess I'll just start. Why not? I don't know. I was frustrated with it, I think is probably the best way to say that. I felt like I didn't quite, I don't know if that's very intentional because like you don't really know what's real the whole time or exactly what's going on. So yeah, I was a little frustrated the whole time, maybe because I was confused.
Yeah, I was also confused. I left it frustrated. Like, what the heck did we just watch? And like, what does any of that mean? And I was like, okay, let me. And so I like started looking up like Virginia Woolf and who she actually even was and like how that relates to maybe what the story was. And like, trying to like piece the puzzle, like, together so that I could figure out like how to make meaning of it. And I feel like since finishing it, I've grown more intrigued by it. So I'm like liking it more now than I did when I first finished watching it. Cause I was kind of just like, what the heck when I first finished. Also, we didn't watch it all the way through. We watched it first half one night and then the first half another night.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if we just didn't finish it.
We didn't finish it.
We get it.
I was falling asleep and then we just had to turn it off and pick it up the next day. But I don't think that impacts my opinion of it.
So well, it's very off theme for the month.
I know, right?
That's so true.
So I made myself. So I was committing to only watching like the first half of it last night. And then once I was in it, I was like, I gotta just push through and just watch all of it now. So it's always funny that you had sort of like the same thing going.
Well, opposite. Yeah.
The opposite.
The opposite. Like OJ. yeah.
Oh, God.
yeah. Marshall, quick hit on your opinion.
I think, I mean, it was pretty like early on in the movie, not really knowing anything other than like Mike Nichols directed it. It was one of those movies where it was like, this was adapted from a stage play. You know, just
I said the same thing.
Mm-hmm. A bunch of characters talking in a room that they don't leave. I was like, okay, you know. And once I like kind of pieced that together, I think it kind of gave me a different sort of lens to like view the movie through. And so in that sense, I didn't mind, I guess, like how much dialogue it was, but I do sort of understand the critique, if you will, that it's a bit relentless, just because if you think about what it really is, it's just a, you know, like a middle-aged couple just really throwing punches at each other. But I, you know, I don't know if we're going to like circle back on like theme or anything like that, but, sure. Yeah, I feel like, my like immediate takeaway was just that it's sort of, I guess, endearing in a sense that like, this is, you know, these two people can, say all of these terrible things about each other and really like go down into the depths and like, you know, in some perverse, like weird sense that they enjoy, you know, they, I don't know, still love each other. Like it's really weird and toxic, but, yeah, I don't know. It was interesting to me, just because my assumption is that, it was maybe kind of unique and groundbreaking at the time. I assume that there maybe wasn't a ton of cinema that had come out up until that point that was just sort of like this domestic, you know, abusive, like, relationship of a couple that's, like, got some weird, I don't know, definition of love. Yeah, I don't know. At least I haven't seen many, what I would say as older films that are like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so the play in the early 60s and this a little later in the 60s were both really controversial in terms of boundary breaking and norm breaking and even the language that they use. So Albee technically was selected for the Pulitzer in drama, but the advisory board at Columbia, which is the body that gives out the Pulitzer, was too offended by it to allow it to actually be awarded to him. Even though the people who select the awards were fine, but it's like, you know, the people who control money at Columbia were like, we can't be associated with that filth. So yeah, wow. It wasn't that was not that long ago either. You know, only 60 years ago. Also, I don't know. So this being a first time watch for everyone, does everyone realize that Elizabeth Taylor is younger than us in this movie? She's just under like 20 pounds of makeup.
Oh,
I think she's 32 when this is filmed.
Wow.
I actually know what everyone's age is, but it's younger than me. So yeah. So that's also part of the weird tabloidy appeal of this. Both of their relationship, Richard Burton was substantially older than her. And she was famous from the time she was a teenager, basically when she made Cleopatra. And then also, come see what she looks like in, as an old person, I guess, or as a middle-aged lady. Because the way that it's filmed in black and white, you can get away with this. But if you see any color images, her hair looks extremely fake and her face looks insane because she's wearing a crazy wig and pounds of makeup. But still acting. I think this per frame, probably the most acting in a movie that we've ever done, I'd say. And it's funny, when you were, Marshall, saying that, like, thinking of it in terms of an adaptation, let you see it through a different lens. Speaking of lenses, said the guy who doesn't know anything about making movies, I think this movie looks insane. I always am interested in seeing how you adapt something meant for stage for film. Typically, common sense is you got to tone down because on stage, everything's bigger than it would be in a camera because you're not this close to someone. I like the idea that Mike Nichols said, go bigger and we'll get the camera closer. And it just looks insane. There's so many things he's doing with focus. Yeah, is that? And who's in focus and out of focus and people popping up from different sides and the bottom of the frame sometimes. And it's just fucking crazy. It's so cool. And yeah, all that to say, I really like this movie quite a bit. I think of it as sort of a psychological thriller. I will say it's definitely more rewarding on a rewatch. Very early in the movie, before, as Richard Burton is going to the door, eventually relents and goes to the door to get it for the guests. He tells, let's just say George, as George is going to the door to get the guests, he tells Martha, don't do the bit with the kid. And then that sort of, you don't know what that means yet. But if you do know what that means already, then it makes it make a lot more sense. So just don't do the fucking bit with the kid tonight. And then he finds out she does. And then that's it. And then it gets sadder.
I heard it. It just was confusing.
Right. Well, why would that mean anything to you at the time?
Yeah, I remember her saying, I think I assumed he meant like, don't do a bit to the kid, like as if referring to the guest.
Yeah, like kid. Don't have sex with the young man who you invited over at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Don't do that bit.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah.
We haven't heard.
What? Oh, sorry. I didn't hear what you said. Yeah, I mean, like Marshall said, like when I was watching this, I was like, this was definitely a play. And I don't know if there's really a lot of movies that I like that have been like play to film adaptations. It's not even so much just the dialogue. I don't know. I feel like there's just. I can't quite say, I'm not sure. So I kind of landed somewhere in the middle. I sort of liked it. I don't really know what I was supposed to take away from it. And I think that kind of bothers me. And obviously it was pretty uncomfortable watching it the whole time. So yeah, it was an interesting watch. I don't think it was my favorite, but I feel like it did some things that were pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's a psychological thriller. In my mind, pretty much. It's very, I think, Marshall, you said relentless. I think that's a really good word for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there is, I guess, sort of a come down once they're on their way back from the roadhouse where they dance and assault each other. And just that there's like some breathing space while George is walking home. But it's not like a relief of pressure or anything. It's just like, downtime, like it's the end of a night where everyone should have stopped drinking and gone to sleep like 3 hours ago, and it's really hitting you.
There were definitely a couple of moments, I think, in like the back half of the movie where I had to like suspend a little bit of disbelief. I think I sort of appreciated why it felt like the younger couple were like locked into this night with the older couple. But there were certainly a couple times where I was like, why have they not gone home? Like,
yeah, this how is you not insane just to leave? Me.
And then the other
excuse
thing,
yourself.
I was like, okay, so they were at a party before this and they've very clearly been like still drinking while at, I guess, the older couple's house. And then they like drive out to a bar. I'm like, are there cops in this town? Do people just used to drink and drive on the regular? Is that okay? Because it's like a college town and the roads are like not highways. But I was just like, I don't understand, but I'll go with it and, you know, see what happens. But yeah, I was just like, I don't know how they have the energy and the stamina. Like, you know, I'm even thinking about it as like a 30-year-old. I'm like, what? How are they doing this? This is insane to me.
I would have been so angry if I was him and she was like, we have guests coming over. I'm like, it's 2:30 in the morning. I should have been in bed 4 hours ago. Like, I would have been so mad. And she doesn't even know what their names are. Like,
I was going to say, the guests are unnamed, correct? Like, they don't have names.
Honey gets a name. Nick is the guy. They never, so very pointedly in both the stage version and in the movie, they never say his name's Nick.
Really?
But it is. Yeah. But Honey is her actual name.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure on that. I wasn't, because I think only he says it. So I wasn't sure if he was just like calling her that.
Or that's possible. I should say that's what she's credited as. And people call it her that. And maybe
Ben, did you read or hear why they didn't really name Nick?
Nope. Because fuck that guy, I guess.
I mean, that's like an interesting choice if you think about it. I mean, it's from like a from like a writing standpoint, it's always a challenge to like organically like state characters' names, because it's like in real life, you know, especially people who know each other, they're not just like constantly saying each other's names. So it always seems weird when characters are stating names a bunch of times. That being said, it's like weird to think that you don't hear it at all. I didn't pick up on that. I guess it didn't really seem important. We had the information that we needed, but yeah, in hindsight, that is a bit strange.
There's a couple
weird because the couple doesn't know who they like, doesn't remember what their names are. And like, so we never find out.
Yeah.
There's a couple times where that's used as sort of a power play where George is like, what's your name? And he also as a power play doesn't tell him.
Mm. Interesting.
And he just says like, oh yeah, more bourbon. I think so as the night goes on, Nick does want to be there because he is thinking about like his career and getting ahead, and him wanting to leave sometimes seems to be like a way to sort of massage what's happening to his wife of like, oh yeah, we'll get out of here soon. But when she's not there, he's just like down. And also he gets really drunk. His judgment is very poor. Mm-hmm. And Honey isn't like a strong enough personality for a lot of the movie to just be like, we're leaving.
Steve, and like, I feel like she had the sort of strangest like roller coaster of a night. Everyone else kind of seemed like, you know, they were pretty constantly, you know, we're very drunk, but also like are saying these crazy lines of dialogue that probably no super drunk person would be able to come up with. That being said, you know, she's half the time like off somewhere throwing up, and then she's a lot of times the like comedic relief in these like really stressful situations. When he comes back and she's just like asleep in the car, I'm just like, this poor woman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She did nothing to deserve this.
Yeah. I think it gets worse for her from there.
Yeah.
Because she is thrown to the ground by George not too long after that. After being after being forced to confront the fact that her husband is actively cheating on her in that moment. And then I don't even think that George has brought up her hysterical pregnancy / potentially secret abortion yet either.
He did. That was in the bar.
That was in the bar? Okay.
Pretty sure, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that when that's not when they play Get the Guests? No, that is in the bar, because he's like, and that's how you play Get the Guests.
Yeah.
Because
that's
easy to follow. They even tell you what they're doing.
That's when the guests finally leave. They're like, that's it. We're finally done. And I was like, they finally got out.
You're going to regret this. Yeah.
Yeah. And then she picks them back up in the car.
They're just too drunk. They're just like, we tried to walk. We clearly, in the last 10 minutes, have only gotten about 200 feet.
Well, she clearly can't drive. Like,
they're just like, I see an open door. I'm just getting in the station wagon, whatever. They probably get in. They're like, oh, no, we should have known it was her, but it's too late.
I like that they do acknowledge it by having her car parked like on the lawn in the end with like the blinker on.
I could think of was the Wolf of Wall Street scene where he's just like, I made it home without a scratch, and then like you see the car all totaled.
Think of people stuck in cars and not being able to leave social situations. Did any of you see the movie from a year or two ago? I think it's like a Danish horror movie called Speak No Evil.
No.
So that was sold incorrectly to me as like, you're not going to believe the ending, crazy stuff happens. And so I was primed for there to be like, the ending is all like aliens come down and, you know, kill the president after this is a movie that there's like a domestic drama set in Denmark and the Netherlands. That's not what people meant. That's not the thing to go into it with. What it is a horror movie about millennials who are too polite to leave a social situation. And so stuff keeps getting worse and worse, but they just keep being like the husband will say to the wife, like, oh, it'd be impolite if we leave now. Like, they were nice enough to invite us to their home. We shouldn't like leave, even though stuff's getting weird. So that reminds me a lot of this movie too. That actually is billed specifically as a horror movie. Fair warning if you want to check it out. Very stressful. Especially for those of you with kids, I don't think you'd like that movie very much.
All right.
Did anyone think he was going to shoot her?
Yes.
Yes.
Like earlier in the movie or after the fake out?
When there's the gun?
Well, both times.
No.
I was going to say, after we saw the fake gun scene play out, Marshall wondered if it was like a Chekhov's gun.
I thought it was going to be, for sure.
I didn't think so.
Technically, it's safe because the gun does go off in that scene. So you don't necessarily have to wait for it to go off later.
I think in hindsight, it's like really, I don't know if I want to go as far as say brilliant, but I think it's a really like smart like narrative decision, because I think doing that so early in the film made me, I think later on, think that that was maybe off the table, because it would be really weird to have that scene and then do like an actual murder or something at the end. So I think sort of felt like it almost took that off the board. But yeah, I also could just be saying that because now I know that it didn't happen.
So
even like they knew that it was a joke. And so like somebody pulled the gun again, but now it's a real gun and somebody ended up dead.
Oh, someone swapped it.
I thought something like that could happen. Even when he was like coming towards her with the gun, I was like, this movie's not about a murder that happens like at a party in front of everybody, is it? Like, I don't know. And I was like, because it's too early in the movie. It's not going to end after this. You know what I mean?
Right.
What would the rest of the movie be if he shot this lady right now? And that was what was going through my head.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
As it was playing out, I was like, we're 20 minutes into this movie. I don't know what's happening, but it's definitely, they definitely filmed it to look like he's insane and he's had enough. But like, clearly the story can't go that direction just yet.
Mm-hmm. That's so cool too. The camera follows him down and then back, and then the quick zooms on everyone's faces, and then Burton's delivery under his breath of just like, "Bang, you're dead."
At the start of the movie, Marshall like was looking at the credits and he pointed out the cinematographer. And so then I was very aware of the cinematography throughout the movie. And I really thought it was good.
I was going to say, it was the last winner of black and white cinematography, because it was split at the Academy Awards between black and white and color at the time.
This was the last year that was the case.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, yeah. I just was saying that I liked the shots and everything. And then Marshall said, did you like the lighting? And I was like, I wasn't paying attention to the lighting. I didn't know that's what it was. That was part of cinematography. But anyway, I liked it.
I mean, it's an interesting way, because I feel like, I mean, and this is maybe just like a film school thought, but like, I think when people think of cinematography, they're usually thinking about like the camera and like the framing, composition and stuff. But like most cinematographers, or you know, people that talk about cinematography like within the filmmaking world, they really think of like lighting as almost like half of it, like if not more. And like a cinematographer, they are in charge of both the camera department and the lighting department. So lighting is very much like a huge component of cinematography, like if not more than like the framing and things. Framing is just what's really flashy, and I think people are more often thinking about it from like a photography standpoint.
The way they light Liz Taylor's face in a lot of her close-ups is always what stands out to me. And then especially the way she's lit in the scene where they're outside of the roadhouse after the dancing and assault. And she's in dark and pacing back and forth, and the camera on her is moving, and it's cutting between that and just the static camera on Burton next to the car. That's good shit. What did you think of the lighting as someone who actually knows what they're talking about?
I mean, I think you can't help but notice the lighting, even if it's like subconsciously, with a black and white film, because I feel like lighting is how you get like your subjects and things to stand out, because like all you really have to work with is like contrast. Because you know, if you're dealing with like a color movie, you can like make people pop with like their wardrobe or set design. Like there's a lot more going on, so there's a lot more to control. And with black and white, you know, I don't know all of the reason. I mean, honestly, looking at the behind the scenes pictures, I feel like maybe the biggest reason for Black and White was, like you said, Elizabeth Taylor being young and her wig does look insane, or whatever they did to her hair. But yeah, I mean, it's like you have to have very like intentional lighting to, I think, make your characters like stand out, especially like if you're, you know, sitting in a house the whole time. So yeah, when Lindsay was talking about the cinematography afterwards, I thought that was interesting because I almost feel like I like switched my brain off of that because I was just focused so much on the character drama. I definitely like there were striking visuals like throughout it, but it wasn't like the first thing that came to mind, I guess, afterwards. It was more like thinking back on it that I was like, yeah, Black and White, just if you have a filmmaker that like knows what they're doing, you know, and a cinematographer, obviously Haskell Westler is like a huge cinematographer. You're going to get, you know, great visuals. But yeah, I rambled. I don't know where I arrived at with all that.
No, I think that was good. I liked it. So there are some specific scenes and sequences that I want to get your takes on. I'm so excited that this is everyone's first time watch besides me. But I'm curious that since at least a few of you thought that there was a good chance this ends in a murder, what you thought of the fact that it sort of ends on a note of this is just what these people do and this is how they enjoy each other's company and spend their time.
So I was 50-50 on this was going to end with a murder or it being like these are just fucking weirdos and this is just a Saturday night for them. They just fucking... My big thing was I was like, do they do this? Like, I wasn't sure it was going to like culminate to finding out like they do this every weekend. Like they invite over people and just fucking abuse the shit out of them, are totally weird. And it almost like this whole thing's a game for them. Like that's how they get their fucking kicks. You know what I mean? Because there was just so much lying going on and like games being kind of played between the two of them. And obviously a lot of it was like real violence and it seemed like legitimate hatred. But every now and then you were like, you weren't sure. So I wasn't like super surprised by the ending. I was a little surprised with how upset she was in the end because I knew there was something going on with the kid. I was like, I assumed there was a child who had like died as a very young kid, or I thought there was like a possibility they didn't exist, but I didn't quite expect it to be exactly like that. So The end was, I don't know, strange for me. Like I said, by the end of the film, I felt kind of just frustrated because I had no idea exactly what was going on, even as the film like concluded.
Yeah.
This is what I remember you had like an interesting takeaway about the kid situation after we finished watching it. Do you remember what that takeaway was?
Well, so I guess, so my take on what happens with the kid is that like, it is someone that they've created in their minds and just like have as a bit between each other. And that because the kid only exists in a bit, like in their stories that they tell and like create the kid through the like bit, that if they choose to, like the fact that he killed the kid in the story means the kid's like the whole existence of the kid is now gone because that's how it only existed was the story. So like, that was my take on why that was so dramatic of a situation, but I don't know if that's how we're supposed to take
that's
that.
That's how I read it too. So
okay. Yeah. Okay. So what the scant details they do establish is that this is something that they did after, for whatever reason, they couldn't conceive. They I think Nick asks right before he leaves, like, "Oh, you can have kids," and they're like, "Yep." And when it's like that shot that's really far away and kind of down on an angle. In their last conversation when the sun's like fully up and it's like 5 a.m. and they're thinking about going to bed, it's probably like 6:30 in the morning or something by then. It seems like they had an agreement that this was just them. And they also had an agreement that like either of them could call it off, and then she's so scared at the end and she's saying like, "So it's just us?" And he's like, "Yeah, it just us now." Like, we have to like make this work without whatever problems, issues, emotions they've been using the imaginary kid as some kind of buffer between them or between themselves as a unit and their issues. They've removed that. And now they don't have that layer of protection from whatever, from reality. I mean, a lot of it is themes about, you know, illusion versus reality and what's real. That's for me and for you to find, for me to know and you to find out, and all the constant lying. And so now there's just like no mask at the end. And they're like in a sad, loving embrace. And she's saying she's scared. And that's how the movie ends.
I think sort of when we're like extrapolating everything about this movie or unpacking it, to me, it makes it more of an effective ending because I think maybe Greg said something like, is this just like every weekend for them? And I think it's because of this idea of the kid and sort of the more like finality of that thing that's like representative of like an actual more important like point in their relationship, or like, you know, it seems like it is significant. It's not just that what they do this kind of shit every week, and maybe they do party and stuff and similar situations have occurred, but because of that and because of the ending, I feel like we're supposed to take away that this is a very like pivotal point in their relationship. So like this is a significant night, not just a, you know, shit that like happens at least to this extent, like every weekend.
Yeah, I think that's something I thought more like in the middle. I think by the end, I felt like there was like, I think maybe they actually say it like that she crossed a line this time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd agree with what everyone's saying that this is, I think, up to the point where he decides that the kid died. This can be, even though she's like crossed whatever line to him. They could just reset from there anyway. But it seems like he, from whatever agreement that they have, that they both respect, is either of them can, you know, eliminate the kid, I guess. I don't know how else to put it.
It is interesting just to go back to thinking about how the line with the kid is that they never talk about the kid with others, you know, with other people around, like friends or whoever, that it's just a thing between them. I mean, I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly the significance of that, you know, like what the playwright's, you know, reason for that is, but it feels significant that it's just this like shared story between them. And, you know, the fact that line was crossed very early, and I think maybe that's why it spirals in the way that it did, because clearly it was a very important line. And not that like the line has to be that the kid he decides is dead now in the story, but that it was that the kid was even mentioned in the first place.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
Oh, that is interesting.
I was also really just thrown off by the whole course of the movie because leading into it, I was under the impression that this was a love story.
It is.
Was that my fault?
Yes.
So it's about love.
Going.
like past lives. It's about love.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
a great capper on our love trilogy that we've done.
Yes.
I would say Past Lives is maybe like a little bit more traditional in how it's like a love story, even though there's like nothing really traditional about it. But I did joke with Lindsay when we were talking about it afterwards, was she's not seen this movie, so the line did nothing for her. But 500 Days of Summer, where like right at the beginning, the narrator's like, this isn't a love story, it's a story about love. And I was like, yeah, it's a story about love, just because it's not like, you know, lovey-dovey.
Ben originally tried to get Robbie on this episode, and he told him it was a rom-com.
Rom-rom?
Yeah. Rom-drom. It'd be tough. So this isn't that old. It was a stylistic choice to do it in black and white. But I still don't think he'd have watched it with it in black and white.
Oh. I never get that. And I mean, the other one that always stings is people are like, I don't want to watch a foreign language film. I'm like, yeah. Come on, bro. Come on.
Yeah. You got to on-ramp them with like Inglourious Basterds. It's like 2/3 of it isn't in English, but you know, you got guns and there are Americans and they make jokes. Some of the sequences that I'm curious about, I'm not necessarily going to take them in order. I guess the one I'm most curious of your thoughts on is the whole, pretty much everything that happens in the bar roadhouse that they're the only occupants of that is desperately trying to close and kick them out. That whole sequence, including the dancing.
I love the dancing. Well, no, I love the wife, the honey's dancing.
Oh, yeah. He never lets her do her interpretive dance.
He only wants to dance like the wind. Interpretive.
The wind.
Yeah.
Dance like the wind. Yeah.
Dance like the wind.
I was on board with that. That was good.
That whole scene, I was just weirded out. I was like, there's nobody here. Like, I don't even know if there's anybody working here. What are you guys doing? It was another bartender point where I was like, just go home.
When the bartender like finally came in, I was just like, this only works because whatever the actual bar is in another room, because these people are like literally like screaming off the top of their lungs and like having an uncomfortable conversation in this public space. I was like, I guess we're supposed to think that the bartender couldn't hear them. Like, I don't know. Like any other place, I'd be like, have they not been kicked out yet? Like, what's going on here?
My thought is it's like a minimum wage job. You're just like, yeah, I'm not dealing with that. It's 4 a.m. I'll wait till they beat each other up and leave.
Yeah, it's just so weird. It's so good. I like that whole scene so much. Just the way they're dancing is great too. And it's like so strange. And then I think it's like a little bit into it where they're like, I like the way you move. I like the way you move too. And then all the encourage me stuff is, it's just so fucking weird.
It's so weird. I kept wondering like the whole movie, especially during this scene, I was like, does she have sex with other people often? Like, cause that doesn't even, it doesn't even seem like that's the biggest issue in this whole thing. So I was like, this just.
Yeah. Like you guys were saying, that's not the line that she crosses that he's citing as like she's crossed a line this time.
Yeah,
he doesn't seem to care that much about that part.
It seems like he was joking about that. I can't remember like the exact moment or whatever, but it seems like he said some things before they even like left the bar, sort of alluding to the fact that maybe she like sleeps around and that like it doesn't seem to bother him much. So I mean, even though I guess we're supposed to believe that they like slept together, he's just like laughing it off. So it felt like that wasn't like the first time or anything. And he's aware of it as well.
Yeah, whole time the weird dancing is going on too, Honey doesn't seem to care that much. She's kind of like...
I think she's disassociating.
She's not antagonistic, but she's like... She's a cause of a lot of problems at the bar. She's like egging them on the whole time as they're like...
Are you your take? Is this her fault?
No.
My interpretation, just based on what we were seeing, was that Honey is blackout.
Yeah,
that's what I thought too. She's too drunk at that point, and I forget what's happening. Someone is talking about something, and the other one's telling them to stop, and she's like, "No, like I want to hear it." Like, oh God, please stop.
I mean, that seems so brutal because our Elizabeth Taylor is like telling the story of George killing his parents. It's like devastating to hear that, especially because we already heard the story, but George wasn't the one doing the killing. Oh my God, that was oof.
But later on, when they're on the same team kind of again towards the end back at the house, They both won't confirm or deny if that actually happened to Nick.
Right.
Yeah. And he's straight up asked, like, did you actually kill your parents? And he goes, maybe. And she's like, and maybe not.
My takeaway was that he didn't, just because that'd be pretty intense if true. you know, I'd have more questions, I guess. So that's just what I chose to take away from that. But
yeah,
who knows?
Her bringing that up is when he straight up starts choking her like against the table in the bar also.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Greg.
So if it's, cause I was the same thing. I have no idea if it's true, but if it's not true and he's choking her, is this all like one big bit?
I think so.
Like, what is happening?
Or not. They won't ever tell you.
I did just, going back to them dancing in the bar, I had a thought just as we were talking about is I wonder if, because obviously, I guess you had said something about for the stage play, like the fact that they left the house was controversial. I don't know if they just like straight up added sequences that weren't in the play or if they just adapted them to leave the house. But if the dancing, so to speak, like actually happened in the house in the stage version, something about however they did that in the story, I just find like that interesting because it, to me, it seems important that it occurred in terms of like the trajectory of how the characters' relationships with one each other evolved. So it doesn't seem to me like it could have been an invention of the movie. Like it seems like that had to have transpired, but thinking about it all happening in the house is like really interesting to me. Like, yeah, I mean, maybe they changed it. I don't know if it was just for a change of scenery because films like to leave one spot. But it makes more sense to me. So I don't know if that was just a creative choice or not.
So aside from locations, it's actually a very faithful adaptation. And so that scene does happen just in the house in that living room. The way they sort of handle the people coming in and out of wherever the camera is, which happens a few different times, is sometimes, so a lot of it is still in the movie. Honey gets sick and has to throw up a lot. And so then that character's just out for a scene or two. Or like when George and Nick are talking, it's because Martha's checking on Honey or showing her around the house or like other reasons that other characters are sometimes gone. So they find different ways for people to be in different places to get different pairings.
I really like that they leave the house, honestly, because the whole time I was just rooting for the other couple to get home. I was like, please let these people leave. Please get them out of here. So them leaving and going towards their house, I was like, oh, thank God, they're free. You know what I mean? And then they have to stop at the bar. I'm like, oh, my good Lord. Like, please, just let them get home. And when they finally leave that door, I was honestly a little relieved that they were finally gone. Like, thank God. Like, maybe these people will be less weird when there's not an audience. You know what I mean? They're not. The next scene is not any less weird. And then the people are back. And when they bring the people back, I'm like, oh, no.
No, they have a very frank discussion in the parking lot where she's doing the snap thing. It's good. And he throws snapdragons at her later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that must have been like a third act twist of a horror movie for you where it's like, oh, we thought our heroes were safe, but it turns out they're actually in deeper.
Yes. I just wanted them to be home. I was like, please, at what point is someone just gonna be like, I have to go to bed? We all have to go to bed.
I was like, you should be in bed. And I was tired watching it, and so I was like cranky that they were up still. I'm like, oh my God, please.
Yeah, I think the first time I saw them making another drink, I was like, oh really? 2:30 in the morning and another drink? Little did I know how many more drinks would be made over the course of the night. Yeah. But God.
Clearly they can party harder than I can, but I was just upset the whole time.
I am. So George is like, you know, so expert level at being passive aggressive, but I'd like the move of straight up like performing an exorcism on someone while they're trying to talk to you. Like that's next level passive aggression. That's really good. I love that scene. There's so much noise happening. And like whatever time you're watching this movie, it feels like it's 5 a.m. and you've been up for 30 hours and you just want to go to bed. Once you hit that point, it's really good. But yeah, just like bring a Bible with you and just read it at someone if they're being annoying. I think that's the move.
I like that they keep getting his department incorrectly. They keep telling him he's going to take over the history department or whatever. And he gets like more and more frustrated about it too, because he eventually yells that it's biology or whatever at one point.
Someone's got to take over the history department. You might as well do it from biology. He's in the math department. Yeah, it's good. He's right in the meat of things.
Yeah, in the meat of things. They do a lot of bits. Maybe that's why I found it so frustrating, because I didn't. It was so hard to tell what was a bit and what wasn't. And I was like, is this just what it's like to deal with me all the time?
Yeah, yeah. You didn't like being on the other side of it.
I didn't like it.
Like sometimes I just want to make plans and it's really hard. It's like, when are we meeting up? Just like, I got to have a moratorium on bits. That's for some reason, half the people that I try and schedule episodes with are just like doing bits. It's like, okay, can we just pick a time first, please?
I don't know what Nick's game plan was from, like, what is the point in, like, trying to sleep with this woman? Like, what is that going to accomplish? You know, like, what is she actually going to do for him, like, as far as advancing his career? It just didn't make any sense to me.
I don't know. If it's, in some ways, a power play against the old guard, George, right? And then also ingratiating himself to the main boss's daughter could have beneficial effects too. I know he's really drunk. That might be all he's going on.
Don't you also say that he's like his marriage, there's not sex in their marriage, like the one that he's in. So he probably really just wants some.
Yeah. She doesn't she used to go up and down but doesn't anymore, or whatever he says.
Yeah.
Anything else stand out in this? We could bring it in for a landing on this if not. Yeah.
The name. Yeah, go for it.
So, Virginia Woolf is known for what? She, like, what is it called? The narrative something?
Stream of conscious.
Stream of conscious. Is that, like, why it's named this? Because it's, like, a stream of consciousness, and, like, we should be afraid of it because it's terrifying.
Edward Albee saw some graffiti in a bar in New York that said, "Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf?" He thought it was funny.
Really?
Yeah.
That sounds about right. I did think
he thought it sounded like the kind of literary pun that like a bored college professor would think was funny.
Okay.
That checks out to me. I did think it was just because it's like a stage play or a stage adaptation. I was like, it's kind of poking fun at itself of like how much talking there is. And it very much is stream of conscious. So it felt like it was relevant, but the reason behind it makes sense to me, because, you know, the title, other than the fact that there is stream of conscious happening, doesn't seem like it is too relevant to the story.
That could definitely be present too. And then Albie just thought it was like a better anecdote to tell on, you know, talk shows or whatever, to say the funnier version.
Mm, yeah.
It is evocative.
I mean, if you want to try to unpack it, you could just say that, like, I guess most movies like about relationships or whatever, or maybe just as a societal thing, it being like taboo to like talk about your feelings. And like this movie clearly is nothing but these characters talking about their feelings. So you could say maybe that's what the title kind of gets at, and maybe why he thought it was good, other than the joke answer. I don't know.
I just wish they talked about their feelings in therapy instead of with this random couple that they're holding hostage.
Right. That's how artists talk about their feelings. They just make art about it.
About their feelings, but they're like talking in weird games about their feelings. Like you have to like read through the lines about what their feelings are. Like
it's great that we just have therapy now that's available that people can do.
You made us some comment.
Telehealth at the time.
When we first started watching the movie, Greg, do you remember who were they arguing about? They were arguing about something.
The Betty Davis quote. Yeah.
The name of a movie.
Yeah.
And Greg was like, "Oh, what? This is just
dump."
Yeah. Greg was like, oh, this is just what life was like before the internet. You just argued about facts until you just, like, you know, got a divorce.
You're like, and we'll never know.
When we were talking earlier, I was just like, oh, you know, maybe this is just people could only entertain themselves on a weekend night just by drinking more, because it's like, you know, there's no computers or smartphones. It's just like, yeah, this is what fucking people do. You know, they get together with other people, get drunk, and like yell at each other. You know, then their options weren't as much in the 2 to 6 a.m. hours.
Yeah, we said that too. There just wasn't anything to do.
Mm-hmm. So when the film rights were acquired by Warner Brothers for this, they originally wanted to cast Betty Davis as Martha and James Mason as George. Mm. And Edward Albee was apparently stoked and thought it would be really funny to have Betty Davis do a Betty Davis impression in that opening scene. This isn't quoted in the like fun facts that I'm reading. But apparently Mike Nichols thought that people would get tired of watching Betty Davis and James Mason because they didn't want to watch 2 hours of screaming between a harridan and a wimp. and he wanted to cast the much flashier Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, which Albee was ultimately fine with, but he still thought that Mason and Davis would have been better. So just another author and director, well, playwright and director in this case, who disagree on the film adaptation.
I think, I guess as watching, my biggest takeaway while watching was that the actors were really good. You know, like I, it's not a really, from an acting standpoint, I mean, my assumption is that all of these actors have some stage experience, because it's so different to be able to get through these scenes where there's not a ton of like cutting between camera angles, and you like have so much dialogue that you have to get through, that's like a really difficult like challenge for an actor to like be able to like stay in the moment and stay in character and get all of these lines. Especially there's this added layer of them like, you know, having to act like they're drunk, and it could easily, I think you could watch it and easily not believe the performances, but I think it's like a testament to like the acting and the directing that I felt like I believed what they were doing for the most part.
Yeah. So this is, at the time, I think probably still the only movie that every credited actor got nominated for an Oscar.
Wow.
Because it's the only credited actors of the four main characters, and they all got nominated. Liz Taylor won. They were all nominated in a bunch of different other stuff too, but that
Funny one is,
and yeah, and Sandy Dennis won for supporting actress. This is Liz Taylor's second best actress. And it was also, at the time, the second movie to be nominated in every category it was eligible in. Or as Greg would say, pretty bad.
Okay. I frustrating.
Oh, that's fair. I just thought that was a fun transition into ratings.
Oh yeah, mine is going to be bad.
On a scale of 0.5 to 5, on any scale of your choosing, aside from stars, what would you give Mike Nichols' undeniable classic 1966 adaptation of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
I got to go first because I only thought of one thing.
Go for it.
4 out of 5 umbrella guns.
Good.
I was considering the umbrella gun.
It's good you think that you went first then.
I'm going to give it 3 out of 5 Bergens.
I was thinking Bergens too.
That's so good.
I'll give it 3 out of 5 stolen ice cubes.
Good about that.
You guys, I'm going to panic now, but I can't think of one.
You never put ice in my drink. And you just eat all the ice.
I was trying to think of what the drink she requested was, and it's not coming to me.
You know, honey was drinking brandy all night, I think.
Yeah. She doesn't mix.
Yeah.
4 out of 5 bits. Stupid bits.
I was thinking Bits too.
Bits is good. There's too many good lines in this movie. I can't really pick one.
Well, you have to.
I was thinking like one of the horrifically sexist things that George calls honey and like just a thrown off way quickly and then moves on before anyone calls him on it. It just happens a few times throughout the movie, but I really, really like the sort of like the energy of this one. So I'm going to go with 5 out of 5 as in every one that it's eligible for, much like every Oscar it was nominated for. So 5 out of 5 bottles that were hopefully empty because you can't afford to waste good liquor on your salary.
Oh,
but she was immediately ready with that in the chamber when he broke that bottle. Mm-hmm. It's like, damn, there's no winning for George here. What a line. Just a fucking haymaker. Like he's already down. He's just smashing bottles on his own staircase. They're just going to bring that one out. God damn. So I haven't established a good question yet for this month, even though this is the third episode. So I guess I could just be like, yeah, houseboy or a stud? No, I'm kidding. So let's instead go with what I've been asking. And again, really, if you have any punch up, please. What's like a situation that you think you could do in a night? That's literally all I've gotten so far.
I don't understand.
Yeah, no one has. So
thank you, Lindsay. Thank you.
So the first two times someone's been like, I guess like game night, but like then there's like a kidnapping in that movie, but like just like having a game night.
I understand like the question now. I understand. Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to be a movie, but yeah. So like Escape from New York, do you think you could rescue the president in like 22 hours with a thing that's rigged to explode in your head? You know, something like that.
Feels like an extreme example. Do I think I'm qualified to do such a task?
No, I'd be bad at
Absolutely
it.
Not.
I'm not on paper qualified, but it's one of those things where in the moment I think I'd step up.
Yeah.
It's like I mean, you feel can like apply and maybe they don't have anyone applying that does have the qualifications. So you should just exactly apply anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lindsay went through the list of possible movies and I wish that all of them were coming to mind right now so I could feel like I could pick one better. What seems maybe the most believable of the ones that I can think of is Superbad because they're just like, I mean, high schoolers going on a bender, you know, young enough to maybe survive all of the things that are happening and still be awake at the end. But also they're not trying to save the president. So, you know, I could maybe do that one. But also I haven't seen Superbad in so long. I'm like, they probably did some crazy shit in that movie that if I had seen it more recently would be like, oh, not that one either.
I don't think I'd run from the cops.
That's true. Yeah.
That's okay. The toughest one for me. But I mean, if you're the fastest kid in the world, I guess you're confident. But
it's one of those scenarios where I've always been like, well, how would I get myself out of this situation? And, you know, if the circumstances were right, maybe so. But I feel like I'm too afraid of authority to attempt such a thing.
Yeah.
I'm thinking like a slasher scenario. I feel like most slashers are like one night kind of movies, you know what I mean?
Who would you be in this situation?
Greg's the slasher.
The slasher.
That's the only way to survive is be the killer.
So listen, hear me out. He didn't say we had to survive. We just have to be in the situation. If I was people, I'd be probably not the first one who dies, but maybe like the second one. I'd probably be the guy who's like, they're like, this someone murdered people. I'd be like, no, that doesn't make any sense. It's not happening. And then like the knife goes right through me and it's like, you know what I mean? So I could be that guy. If I'm going to live, I'm going to be the slasher. The people in the movie, the other people, they're so stupid. It'd be cake. I'd have no problem murdering them all, I feel like.
The only problem if you're the slasher is you have to, right at the end, convincingly seem like you're dead. But then, like, in the last shot of the movie, you have to be like, no, I'm actually alive.
So that's
the only trick. You just got to work on the bit.
So I can do that.
Okay.
The big advantage I have over most of them is I can run. I'm fast. You know what I mean? Most of them just walk or lumber even. So that gives me a big advantage. And a lot of them do a lot of bits, and I'm already good at bits. So I feel like I could do that well.
Honestly, there's a pitch here for a movie that we should probably take offline, but like a really good DM that like gets too into it and somehow confuses reality and fiction, but also has the means to put their players into like life and death situations.
Ooh, I could just do this.
Yeah, Dungeon Master. I would direct message. I was like, okay, what's going on?
So it's basically like Saw, but with a fantasy tinge. Mm-hmm.
And you do it to your friends.
And you do it to your friends, and you don't know why they're so much better at role playing this time. They seem really into it, into the stakes of this situation. No one's checking their phone this time.
There's something there. Explore it.
This isn't as good as my other pitch that we've done on a podcast. It was from a while ago, but I think it was with Greg and Ray. Do you remember me talking about Air Force Z? It's like Air Force One with zombies.
It's like Air Force One and World War Z.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
I remember this, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
At one point, all the media turns into zombies and someone's like, oh no, the press corpses.
I do remember
instead
this.
Of like the press
yes. I also understand now why you need a way to distinguish between films and actual films.
Yeah. Yeah, none of those. I wouldn't say Air Force Z necessarily sustains 90 minutes, but but Dungeon Master, I mean, there's like 14 Saw movies. Like, we can make it work. Anyway.
For sure.
Did everyone go yet on Raiders?
Oh, I'm kind of thinking like, all I can think of is like Jaws. Like, I'm just not going to go in the water and then it's done. The story's over.
<You know? laughs> Like skirting the parameters.
Yeah.
It's if just you a just don't day partake in the film, it's easy to survive it.
So you don't necessarily have to survive. Like Marshall's answer was going to a party. So
fair.
So yeah, it doesn't have to be like something's trying to kill you, but the fact that that was Greg's go-to means maybe you should be prepared for that.
Mm. Yeah, I'm a little worried that he's identifying with a killer here. I just immediately went like horror because I was like, well, I feel like there's a lot of stupid things that happen in horror where you could just like change something and it's done in an hour.
Yeah. Know? A lot of the options were, I was surprised when I looked at how many movies take place in one night, but I guess it makes sense that a lot of them are horror because it's mm-hmm. condensed time period, intense, and it's hard to sustain horror over a long term because eventually you're like, well, you should just like get in a car and drive away.
Yeah, go call the police.
Right, if it's not happening generally in real time.
One we didn't mention, which I think we were all on the episode for, was Before Sunrise. Seems
that's what I was gonna say.
Seems doable.
Yeah. I want to do that adventure. That'll be my choice.
Yeah. How many random Americans do you think just like get off the train in Vienna and are like, all right, where's the blonde ladies?
I was like, maybe we touched on this in that episode, but I was like, is this situation even possible anymore? Because people would just be like on their phones. Like no one's meet cutes are such a like thing that are so rare in today's age that it seems like maybe this situation would be very, very impossible.
I think we did discuss that. I feel like the percentage of sexual assaults is much higher than meet cutes too. So I feel like people are more weary.
I also think if you look at a lot of older rom-coms, a lot of those meet cutes are sexual assault.
Yeah,
and it's just changing mores and social, you know, norms.
Yeah, College Humor has a good skit about that.
Oh damn! Now it seems like I'm ripping off College Humor. God, I didn't know that. I was never into College Humor, so.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, on that note, anything else on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, or just yeah, I guess movies and generally, I don't know. We're in a weird.
I am curious because I know Lindsay hasn't seen it. Greg Gray, I'm assuming Ben's seen it. I'd be, you know, have y'all seen The Graduate?
No.
Nope.
It's his next movie, and it's amazing.
1 year later, insane. Yeah. And he doesn't win Best Director for this, but he does win Best Director in a year for The Graduate.
Yeah, I have a I have like an alternative poster for The Graduate, and, you know, getting ready to move into Lindsay's place. And it's a, you know, it's a beautiful poster, I'll say. Too bad it's not in this room. I'd just show it to you right now. But Lindsay's like, well, we can't put it up on the wall until I've seen the movie. And I was like, well, I guess we better watch it then.
You should watch it.
Without spoiling, like, two sentences, what's the movie?
So the movie essentially, so the main character is played by Dustin Hoffman. He's someone who's just graduated from college and doesn't really know what to do with his life quite yet. He's still figuring it out. And then stuff around him happens. And yeah, that's all. That's what I'll say about it.
I could get into that.
I would say there's a lot of pieces that are talked about in it. The soundtrack is Simon and Garfunkel. If you know the song, like, we're going to Scarborough Fair, that happens a lot. It's pretty funny. And then, you know, the song Mrs. Robinson, maybe, you know, anyway, that's this. And
Sound of Silence.
Yeah. And then also the ending is so singular that the term this movie had a graduate ending is a thing. So
mm-hmm. It's definitely one we talked about a lot in film school.
No spoilers. I gotta watch it soon.
No spoilers.
I really skirted around like the plot just because, yes. I didn't want to spoil anything. I gave as broad of a stroke as I could.
Okay. Well, thanks everyone for being on this episode. We had Lindsay, Greg, Craig, Ray, and Marshall.
Thanks.
Woo. Yeah. You can find our stuff on Linktree, linktr.ee/late-to-the-movies. Marshall mentioned Superbad before. That is coming up, I think, this month. We'll see. I think we're going to try and get After Hours in there, too. I don't know. Schedules are weird. We'll figure it out. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Craig. That's it.
See ya.